Blog Talk Radio. My daddy told me he loved me. He told me I was the best. He worked real hard for his family. Sometimes two jobs. My daddy told me he loved me. He gave me his gift of song. I didn't need to find a man to be my daddy, 'cause I had one. My mommy told me she loved me. She told me I was the smartest girl in the world. She taught me to have an opinion, to look beneath the surface.
Hey, dogs in that room, they haven't gotten here yet.
Okay.
You can join me on my Blog Talk Radio program if you want. Greetings and good morning. This is the Legacy of a Nation, the UNIA, the ATL, State of the Black Race. And of course, as always, most of you are somewhere else. Straight behind the black wall. Okay, pop the lights on, the lights are to your left. As most of you, you're always crossing the Serengeti at the wrong time. The lions are full because you have become lunch. You see, we take too many things for granted. Time is one of them. Time is our passion. But see, I don't look at time from a Western standpoint. I look at time from Mother Nature. Mother Nature dictates the time and the thing. You see, when its flowers bloom, it is spring. When the flowers blossom and grow and bear fruit, it's summer. When the leaves begin to fall to the ground, it's fall. And when the trees and plants are bare, it's winter. And so we must begin to follow nature's clock. And we have some good people in the building today. I wonder if they would join me and state their reason for being here at the UNIA. It looks as if they may be going to do something cultural. Yes, maybe no.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. My name is Ramesses. This is the UNIA ATL, State of the Black Race.
Yes, introduce yourself.
Yeah. My name is Willard Lett. I'm the Secretary of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, Northeast Region.
All right. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
I'm here today to attend the annual meeting of the NCOBRA Northeast Region, where we will be electing new officers as well as laying out our plan for developing NCOBRA in the Northeast. And the Northeast Region is comprised of District of Columbia, Delaware, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York State, Maryland, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Those states in the District of Columbia comprise the Northeast, and we're preparing to develop NCOBRA's mission and NCOBRA's work throughout that area. And we're also preparing for the upcoming National NCOBRA Conference in Miami, Florida, from June 23rd to the 26th.
Right. This meeting today is from what time to what time?
The annual meeting today is from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. here at the UNIA headquarters in Philadelphia.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Now, you know, we planned this meeting, and I guarantee you three people don't know what's going on. No. Those are for auction or $200 a piece. The other hats are $25. And the shirts, those are $25. You're looking at the Skullinarians. You know, people are looking around in the shop and just looking at the different things that are going on. The UNIA is here today. It was started in 1916 in this country. It was started in 1914 in Jamaica. The creator and organizer of the UNIA is, of course, Marcus Messiah Garvey, who was born 1887, August 17th, in St. Anne Bay, Jamaica. Okay, so we're waiting for our guests to arrive. They should be here by 9:30. We definitely appreciating our house guests today. And while we're waiting, we'll be listening to Dr. Ed Robinson's African Genesis Theory. You know, we always have a backup for when everyone is doing what they do. Perhaps they went out last night and had an extra good time. Well, we do the same, but we understand our obligation. See, when you're dealing with race first, and you're dealing with the liberation of ourselves, we can only continue to be where we should be. All right, Dr. Ed Robinson's, let's go to Black History Month, because that lasts 43 minutes.
Good afternoon. Hoi Bani. That's good afternoon in ancient Songhai language. Hoi Bani. Let me hear you say Hoi Bani. We are the Songhaian people. But of course, we haven't been told that. So we don't know anything about Songhai. This is why my brother and I wrote a book called The Journey of the Songhai People, to let the Songhai people know who they are. I've been reading the obituaries for the last number of years, and I got frightened to death. All the people in the 80s who were around 80, some were dying off. And I got frightened and frightened. I was so glad a few years ago when I passed 89, I became 90. Now I'm 93. So my 80s are behind me. I don't know how many of you have seen this article on television where a Republican woman, head of a Republican committee, put a picture in there of our president dressed like a chimpanzee with two other chimpanzees in the picture. Her name was Davenport. I want to send a message to Davenport. I want you to help me send it, because I want to tell her what a chimpanzee looks like. So when I mention some of the characteristics of a chimpanzee, I want you to say, shame on you, Republican Davenport. Let me hear you say that. Shame on you, Republican Davenport. And this is being videotaped. So we're going to make sure that she gets this videotape. Well, first of all, Republican Davenport, the ape has straight hair. Shame on you, Republican Davenport. And that straight hair has head lice, just like the chimpanzee has the head lice. The louse is called the Malofaga, head louse. So the head lice is not like our president. So shame on you, Republican Davenport. Next of all, the chimpanzee has thin lips. Shame on you, Republican Davenport. The next thing is that the chimpanzee has large ears. Black people have the smallest ears closest to the head of any race on the planet. Shame on you, Republican Davenport. Now, the chimpanzee has a flat behind. Shame on you, Republican Davenport. And for the big one, the chimpanzee has a white skin. Shame on you, Republican Davenport. They've been pulling that false thing on us for years and years and years about our being closest to the ape, when all they have to do is just have a picture or go to the zoo and look at the ape. doesn't look anything like us at all. My research shows that 20 years ago, a group of English archaeologists found a vase in our motherland, in Egypt. And they unearthed it in a substrata of earth 9,000 years old. And they found this vase made by our mothers and fathers 9,000 years ago. And on the vase were inscribed the words, fraction one half. Now, what does that tell us? That tells us that our fathers and mothers at least 9,000 years ago had reading and writing. We gave the world reading and writing 9,000 years ago. And it tells us, and we have the picture of the vase and the documentation to prove it, that the vase tells us we had mathematics 9,000 years ago. In fact, 3,700 years ago, we gave algebra to the world by one of our fathers whose name was Ahmed, and his book today showing how algebra was created is in the British Library in London today. We have pictures of the pages of that book. So it's no question that not only did we give civilization to the world, but it was thousands and thousands of years before any other race. In fact, the first book in Europe was written by Homer 2,800 years ago, 7,000 years later. Now, Homer said in his book, the Iliad, how many of you heard of the Iliad and the Odyssey? Oh. Well, these are highly educated folks. He said in there that every year the gods of Greece traveled to Africa to sup with Africa's faultless people. And wait a minute. Faultless people. Faultless in beauty. Faultless in intellect, faultless in morality, faultless. That means without fault. This is what the Greeks thought of us. Not only did they just say that, but they named their most beautiful star constellations after two black queens, Cassiopeia and Andromeda. So I think we should give ourselves just a hand for our fathers and mothers. We are the descendants. African Americans are the descendants of those people who came from ancient Egypt in the 7th century over to West Africa. And we became the Songhai people. I won't go into why we left. That's a whole story all by itself. It's in my book called The Journey of the Songhai People. But I don't have time today to go all into that. We must think about who we are, the Songhaians, the Songhai people. I just want to let you know that in our morality, we're the most humane and forgiving of all people. We forgive the folks who put us in slavery for 246 years without a payday. Then after we won the Civil War, in 204 battles of the Civil War, and Abraham Lincoln admitted that if it weren't for the black soldiers, they would have lost the war. He admitted it along with General Butler, and the other Northern generals. And after we won the freedom for United States, we had 18,000 of our fathers and mothers lynched. We are a very forgiving people. We're the only ones who speak the language of those who are our enemies. The only way we communicate with each other is in French, English, Spanish. And they were the three people who enslaved us and who lynched us. We were very forgiving and humane people. Now, psychologists say that if a brain feels, if your brain feels that you come from a territory, the inhabitants of whom, in ancestral land, were of high intellect, then your brain will operate on a very high level. They have a name for that. It's called a territorial imperative, which means if you believe in your heart that you came from a country or a nation that was highly intellectual and did great things, then you will operate on a very high level. I wanted to prove that one day, and I was asked to come to a school where the children were not operating on a high level. In fact, they were operating on an academically low level. Called the Leeds School. Some of you may have heard of the Leeds School in Mount Airy. And we went in there and we told them that their fathers and mothers were not the people that you've been taught that they were. They did not come from a jungle. They came from beautiful cities in West Africa called Songhai. And we told the children that our fathers and mothers gave reading and writing to the world, and we proved it to them. We told the children that our mothers and fathers were considered by world intellectuals as the greatest scientists there are. That next year, the children's marks in mathematics went from a C all the way up to a B+, and their behavior became exemplary. Now, the school district asked me, could we do that for bad children? So they sent us to William Penn High School one summer, where they had 300 black children, and they asked me to see if we could make their marks go up and make their behavior become exemplary. I said, how many weeks are you going to give me to do that? They said, 6 weeks. We turned them around in 6 weeks. Their parole officer said, if we hadn't seen it with our own eyes, we wouldn't believe it. Today, the lady who was my lead teacher at Leeds School left Leeds School because downtown did away with our program called the African Genesis Program, which meant that we taught our children the real history of the world, inclusive of our African history. And they knocked it out. And her name was Christine Wiggins. And she said, well, I'm going to have to continue this, so I'm going to have a charter school named after one of our fathers whose name was Imhotep. That Imhotep Charter School is the number one school in Philadelphia, high school, from 9th to 12th grade. It's up at 21st and Godfrey. I think we should give her a hand for doing that. Christine Wiggins. Now we know that when we have our children and have our people know who they are, just like, and we don't blame them, white people have their children learn about King Arthur and the Round Table, all about Napoleon and Caesar, and they should, to glory in their glory of their ancient land, their ancestral land. But they deny us in the school system to allow us to teach the children about the glories of West Africa. Now, here's how that came about. Back in the 1700s, our fathers and mothers were raising cane on the plantations. They were fighting the man. They were burning his houses. They wouldn't work. They were under guns. And they had to be coalesced and whipped into working freely without any payday. And so a group of the plantation owners got together and said, we're going to find a man who knows about these people, the Songhai people. And they found a man over in Germany. His name was Johann Friedrich Blumenbach. Now, he was an expert on Songhai history and African history. White boy. Now, he's white. And he was the head of anthropology at a German university called Guggenheim. And so the plantation owners from Virginia and North Carolina and South Carolina went over to see him. And he said, we can't control them. So we captured them, they're prisoners of war. We captured them in a battle in 1591 and brought them over in chains to America to work for us under guns, but they fight us back. So Blumenbach asked him, said, well, do you let them know about Songhai? And plantation owners said, well, how can we prevent it? Because the mothers and fathers tell the children who they are. They tell them that they came from beautiful homes, that they came from schools and universities. So how can we stop the mothers and fathers from telling the children that? So Blumenbach said, easy. He said, easy? How do you mean easy? He said, what you do, as soon as a boatload of them arrives, you take the babies out the mamas and daddy's arms, send the parents off to a distant plantation and work them to death, with no contact with the children, then you teach the children that they came from a jungle. Now, children don't know anything about it. So they'll grow up and never heard of Songhai. You are the descendants of those babies that were snatched out to mamas and daddy's arms and raised to believe that you came from a jungle, so that you wouldn't be able to do the same thing that the English kids do in school when they know all about King Arthur and the Round Table, and they know all about the greatness of Napoleon, they know all about the greatness of Caesar. That's why they do well in school. Then we found that when we gave our children the same insight on their parents, our parents, the beauty and their grandeur, those children's marks went way up too. So not only was it me the greatest in athletics, but also greatest in the classroom when they knew who they were. Reminds me during the 60s. The white psychologist said the reason your children do badly in school is because they're born dumb, born stupid. The black psychologist of Pennsylvania challenged them, said that's not true. It's because we have not given them the same information that all other children, Orientals, Jews, white people, get about the beauty and grandeur and sophistication of their ancestors of the ancestral land. So the white psychologist says, that's not true. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll devise a test and test newborn babies, and we'll prove to you that black babies are born stupid. So they devise a test for newborn babies, whether they can follow light, whether they can follow sound, whether they can respond to certain other stimuli. And they devised this test and tested white babies, black babies, Asian babies. And to their shock and horror and surprise, black babies came out first. Uh-oh. White say, uh-oh, something's wrong with this test. So they devised another test. Same thing. Reminds me of the story of Little Sam. Maybe you heard it. Mandy worked for Miss Ann. Now, I know you all know what I'm talking about. And Mandy and Miss Ann gave birth to baby boys the same day. After 4 days, Mandy came back to work with Little Sam under one arm and his bassinet under the other to wait on Miss Ann, who was still upstairs recovering from her terrible ordeal. And then she put Little Sam in the corner of the kitchen in his bassinet and went on upstairs and took care of business. Months passed by. And she called downstairs, Mandy, come upstairs, quick. Mandy, come. Mandy left Little Sam in the corner of the kitchen in his bassinet and went on upstairs. And there Little Gregory Harrison III was saying, Dada. Dada. Mandy said, oh, that smart little boy. Oh, she swept him up into her ample bosom and said, oh, she was so smart. You little blue-eyed thing, you were so smart. Saying Dada already. And gave the bundle of joy back to his mama. Went downstairs in the kitchen. Little Sam raised his head and said, Mama, what was that all about? But what happens to Little Sam? Well, first of all, the English language degrades him. Mama, what's that you back mixing up there? This is 3 or 4 years later. Mama, what's that you mixing up there? She said, this is devil's food cake. Oh, he said, that's that dark cake. Well, what was that light cake you were beating up the other day? He said, that was angel's food cake. Beating up on the boy's head, making him feel less than human. Don't let that black cat, what's the matter, my black cat, bad luck. Black is bad. Beating up on his head. And expect him to be able to compete with somebody who thinks everything white is right. Do you understand what I'm talking about? We got to change our language. My family, any of my grandchildren, any of my children, use negative words for black around my grandchildren. I take them out my will. That makes them straighten up. And when you're 93, you got a whole lot of wedge on time body. They say, yeah, you better straighten up, man. Is that right? I got a powerhouse, on, you know, yeah. Yeah, so Little Sam grows up, but he ran into an old eagle. The eagle told him who he was. Remind me of the story of this eagle. There's an eagle called an emperor eagle. Now, an emperor eagle can be at the bottom of the Empire State Building and fly straight up to the top. His wings are so powerful. That's an emperor eagle. The other eagles have to take a little run and go up on an angle. But an emperor eagle can go right straight up. Well, this farmer had a barnyard full of white chickens. And he wasn't doing too well monetarily. And his friend told him, he said, look, do you know you got an emperor eagle up there in the mountain? Go up there and capture that eagle and bring her down and show her off and charge admission. You make yourself some extra money. Farmer said, that's good. He went up there to get this Emperor Eagle and could bring her down, but she's strong. She was whipping him half to death. Boy, he took out his gun and killed him. The friend said, maybe that wasn't a good idea because she knew who she was. What you do is take those two eggs she laid, bring the eggs down, put them under a setting hen, and in time when the eggs hatch, when they come out, they won't know who they are, and you can tell them anything. They don't know who they are. So that's what the farmer did. And in time when the eggs hatched, when he came out, farmer called him Tom. So Tom ran around with the chickens. He thought he was just a dark chicken. So he got himself some chicken nola and put on his feathers to lighten him up a bit. Then he noticed that the feathers on his head stood up. You know, Emperor Eagle, he's a bad boy now. And he said, uh-oh, I got to stick my head down like these white chickens. So now he's getting lighter and lighter, putting that chicken nola all over his feathers. You know. And he got himself what do they call him, a do-rag? Got himself a do-rag, put on his head to kind of slick the feathers down a little bit. In time, the other egg hatched. But when this little eaglet came out, he kind of broke bad as soon as he came out. Farmer stamped his foot, Tom would run, and the chickens would run. And this little guy just stood still and glared up at it. He was the real Emperor Eagle now. He was a bad boy when he came out the egg. He was bad. Farmer called him Turk. So Tom ran over to Turk and said, now look, from now on, do something about that color. You're too dark. Now here's some stuff. You put on your feathers and see how light I'm getting? See how light? And then do something about that head. Here's something to wrap around there and you press it down real hard. So Turk said, look, I like my head just the way it is and I like my color the way it is. I don't know about you. So, and Tom said, and by the way, just don't call me Tom, call me Uncle Tom because I'm older than you. He said, okay, Uncle Tom. He said, we're not playing with you. Poor little Turk had to wander all around the barnyard by himself. And one day he looked up in the sky, and there he saw a speck appear. And the speck got larger and larger and larger. It became the largest bird he'd ever seen. It was an Emperor Eagle. And he looked down and spied a little Turk down there on the ground. And he came in on a branch hanging over the barnyard and said, what are you doing down there with those chickens? He said, I am a chicken. No, you're not a chicken. What am I? You're an emperor eagle. What's that? The strongest, biggest bird in the sky. All of the birds in the sky have been looking up to your fathers and mothers for thousands of years. That's who you are. He said, but, you know, come up on this branch and I'm going to rap with you a while. Come on up on this branch. He said, I can't fly that. You know, chicken. I told you you weren't a chicken. Now spread your wings. Turk spread his wings. Now flap them. He flapped them. He flapped them. And to his surprise, he rose higher, higher than it ever risen before and came in on the branch with the old eagle. Old eagle said, now settle down here. I'm going to tell you who you are. Your mother and father ruled the skies for thousands of years, looked up to and admired by all the birds of the sky. We live in a great land called Eagle Land. It's so high up, the other birds can't even come up there. Oh, he said, yeah, but what about our color? We're not white like those chickens. He said, don't you know what that color represents? Represents royalty. Royalty. Oh, he said, this is so deep. Oh, he said, what about the feathers on my head? He said, that's your crown. All kings and queens have crowns. Oh, he said, let's tell Uncle Tom. He said, Uncle Tom. Oh, Uncle Tom raised his hand. Man, you better come down out that tree before that farmer comes out here. He said, no. The Spaniards tell us our history. He said, I don't want to hear anything about no history. I'm too busy down here eating with these friends of mine. These white friends of mine. I don't want to leave them. He said, no, he's going to... He said, old Regal said, look, he's too brainwashed. You know, some people just too brainwashed. You can't talk to them. Too brainwashed. He said, let's fly off to our destiny. And they took off. And pretty soon they came from a deep valley. It was a valley of American oppression. And Little Eagle said, we'll fall into that valley. Old Eagle said, you won't fall. Because you have the strength of kings in your wings. Fly on. And he flew safely over the valley of oppression, of American oppression. And pretty soon they came to a desert. It was the desert of mediocrity, the desert of don't care, the desert of a C average. The young Eagle said, I don't see any trees in sight on which to alight, to rest. He said, you don't need rest. You're an emperor eagle. Fly on. And they flew on. And pretty soon they came to a high mountain. It was the mountain of American injustice. The young eagle said, we'll crash into that mountain. The old eagle said, you won't crash. You'll fly safely over the mountain of American injustice because you have the strength of kings in your wings. And we say to you, Songhai people, you are the emperor eagle. I know they're trying to keep that from you. You're the ones under the heel of greatest oppression that any race has ever endured in history, has given 18,000 inventions to America and the world. The electric railway system, the air conditioner, the elevator, the computer. Even though you were beaten over the head from the time you were a baby, you still was creative. What would have happened if they hadn't beaten you over the head with negativity and degradation about our color and hair and features? We would have solved the problem of AIDS by now. We would have solved the problem of heart trouble by now. We would have solved problem of Alzheimer's by now. I don't want to chase people out the room. I got to tell the truth. But I want to leave something with you. I've talked long enough. The old folks, when they get to talking with a microphone, boy, you're in trouble. But about in 1584, I'm going to tell you what happened. And it's in my book called The Journey of the Songhai People. I'm just going to give you a little smattering of it now. And that's out there ready for you when you leave here. You're the Songhai people. You're the ones that gave...
when everybody hung up.
Right.
I had the phone because the lady was talking on me.
All that program we just did, all that knowledge, is held to us.
Oh, well, that meant it was for us.
My goodness. My goodness. All right.
Mute doesn't mean it didn't hear go out. Mute means that
the phone wasn't transmitting the sound.
Well, you can't cry over it now.
Welcome to the Legacy of the Nation. For the second time. The first time we had guests in the room, and I made a technical error. We had a wonderful program today, and we have an hour left. So what we're going to do is recap fast pace. So to recap the program, homelessness, the African in America, food deprivation, the African in America, medical poison, the African in America, serving in prison, our only results. Please recap.
Well, recap very quickly. Yes, the African in America could be seen as homeless, but your point was because of gentrification. I'm saying you could be seen as homeless, not so much relating to the gentrification of a particular community in America, but because you don't acknowledge and we do not have a government on the continent of Africa that speaks for us, and Africa, therefore, is our home. So we will move from our home, even those of us who want to accept America as their home, we will be moved from our home, brought here. Not all of us in chains, because other African men and women were here, and they were free. So that's homelessness. Number two, you said medicine. The medicine that we take is poisonous. They tell you that when they give you a medicine and a pill and then tell you you got 900 different side effects that you got to watch out for. There's something wrong when you have to take something and have to be that concerned about side effects. So, yes, that's true. The food. The processed food is not good for your body. All this stuff that goes into making food to where they want to make it quick is also not good for your body. So that's true. Now, going to prison, first thing we have to understand is that going behind the wall means that you are economical energy behind the wall, and they want to put you there. They want to put you there because that's the fastest growing industry in America still to this day. $35,000 a year to keep a man in prison, $35,000 a year could give a man an education, and he wouldn't be in prison. They could invest the money another way. However, in order to generate the money, they got to lock you up. Because that puts white people to work. That's guards and prison inmates and doctors and the whole industry that relates to prison. It's like there's a whole industry that grew up around illegal drugs. Whole industry. The illegal drugs, now we've got to do drug rehabilitation. Illegal drugs, so now we give you methadone, another drug to counter the other drugs that you was taking. It's America. It's business. Recap.
Fear of governing ourselves.
Okay. Again, some of this conversation we had, we don't fear it, we don't accept it, because with the government that we have established in the Universal Negro Improvement Association, you have to accept it, and you have to accept its rule. And whereas America has the government, you don't have to accept it. You hear, you have to abide by it. It is what it is.
Enrichment of governing ourselves. We provide a military for ourselves, and we go running to the military of the other government.
That's our mindset. That's our Western mindset. That if you establish a security force to your own people, you become a challenge to the security force that's established by the Western government, the American government, that whole, or the West India, whatever that government may be. Because you look at that and you say, oh, and that's because we have that, we don't think through our own cultural sensitivity, because we don't know who we are regardless of the knowledge that we have of that past. You have to know it, not just be able to recite it. You got to live it. You got to feel it. You got to reach back, pull it forward to help you understand. You see, so therefore, even when we talk about a government and people say, well, I didn't have a good experience, so it ain't negative, it ain't positive, it's negative. Well, no, it's not. Your experience is generally based on what you bring to the table. Your experience ain't because of what I bring to the table. It's what you bring to the table.
new question wasn't asked earlier. Why won't we feed ourselves? That means to get our hands back into agriculture. Agriculture is one of the key industries of a nation.
That's true. But people believe we have progressed. And progress means I don't have to be a farmer. Someone else can do it. And so as people move away from ironwork, people move away from carpentry, people move away from welding, people moved away from farming, and we also don't have land like we used to. You still got black farmers who live it every day. And so what we need to do is connect to the black farmers. And then we can feed ourselves through their effort, because now we become linked together when we aren't linked.
I've heard people say, when I talk about the black farmers organizing a black farmers food distribution group of Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
and I talk to the black people of Philadelphia, and some of those people who were in prominent positions in Philadelphia, statement to me was, I don't have to prepay at the supermarket. What should I do?
People are conditioned to function under this conditions in America. So you're right. It's going to be difficult to convince black people to give you money and then you go buy the food and then come back and give it to them. They're not conditioned for that. It's not who they are.
Education. Philadelphia is closing down schools left and right. They're tearing them down left and right. They're turning them into condominiums.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we parading in the streets and raising money for a floundering project instead of the African independent schools that once stood?
And this is going to sound redundant, but we believe that public education is supposed to educate us, and therefore it has to have a public education system. Now, with a public education system, it means no one can be denied education. That's what it means. So, you may have a failing system. We have a challenging system. But our mindset doesn't say, okay, we can establish another and make sure it's incorporative that everyone can attend and grow and gain the knowledge and have the economics, because people think that public education is free. It's not free. See, you paying for that through your property tax, through your sales tax, the mere fact that the state taxes you and the state is supposed to put so much money into the school systems, wherever they are. So you are paying for it, but the mirage is that it's free. See, so they got you tricked under that spell this is free, and I'm supposed to have this. I'm supposed to have free education. So I'm both that. But it's not free. Because if it was free, you wouldn't have a charter school. Because charter schools getting paid. The state pay them to educate those children. That they can pick and choose who they want. Because our children have challenges, and they take challenges to school. So you believe it's free, and you definitely want it because it's free. You don't care how messed up it is, it's still free. Because other than that, you got to pay. Duh, you're paying anyway.
The word free, the poison of our people. When I talk about building, And I talk to the African people here in America.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that they do not envision building a nation as a way to receive benefit other than being paid by a foreign dollar to work for themselves?
Because they can't conceive freedom. If you are already free, at least that's what you believe you're already free. So if you're already free, why you got to build a nation to be free? I'm already free. But stop for a minute. If, are you really free? And if your answer is yes, then it's not a thing I can tell you to change your mind. See, so you don't have, because you think you already have it, you don't have to go get it. And for those of us who believe that we need to go get it, and some people think they believe they need to go get it, but yet what they attempt to do is tear down getting it.
Well, we've had a beautiful conversation, let me tell you. I'm sad that I made that technical error and didn't discover it until late, but these things happen.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a few minutes left, and we have our favorite person who I totally disagree with all the time on air. Bianca, greetings and good afternoon. How are you?
Well, you've been talking to yourself for three quarters of the program. But sometimes it's good to talk to yourself, because it would be difficult for you to blame yourself for not listening to yourself, like other people don't listen to.
I like that. All right.
Now, the gentleman said something about black American citizens shouldn't join the military. I disagree with that. They should join the military because they... citizens of this country. And the military provide training. It provide educational opportunities. And once you've stayed there for a period of time, it provides a handsome pension. How else? Where else are you going to duplicate that?
I don't know that the pension is handsome. I do know they provide it. But we didn't say that. That wasn't stated this morning. And I didn't state it.
Yeah, and another thing, black folks are free. I mean, if they not, they can go where they want to, eat what they want, those within their own means. There's nothing guarantee you equality. It guarantee you the ability to access that which would make you equal or even ahead. I agree with you on the public schools, but, you know, you have black organization, Vanguard organization, that promotes the public schools.
Yeah. Your phone is breaking up again this week. What's going on in your neck of the woods?
I don't know. Only when I call you.
Is something going on? Let me find out how Indiana phone is doing. 4324. Greetings and good morning to Legislative Nation, UNIACL. I know you just chimed in. You may have been trying to listen earlier. What's on your mind?
Well, actually, I was just peace. How you doing? I was just trying to listen. That's all. Didn't really want to say nothing. Just was listening.
All right. Well, thank you for chiming in. Greatly appreciate you.
Okay.
We're down to 50 minutes, and we kind of recapping things because of a little technical difficulty. But you know, life goes on. I tell you to. Have been part of all of what we're saying. You know, it's just about like listening now. Bianca made a great statement. He said, sometimes you're talking to yourself.
And it's necessary.
And hey, listen, Bianca, on that one, I can't argue with you. Because talking to the Africans here in America, especially those like yourself, sometimes speaking is a moot point. What we do and continue to do because we must as a people. So, Mr. President, here's a question of really preference. Think about this. Think about this. And answer if you so choose. Today is a great day because you can't hang up and run away. As a people who, in my view, tend to see God, Jesus, the Creator, as someone other than themselves, do you feel that that has the total and the dynamic impact of why we make statement of turn the other cheek, and I'm going to continue using the word fear of doing for self?
Your question is, do I believe that Christianity and the fact that black people for a time believe that the Creator or the Christ was white, and did that have an impact on us? Yes. Yes, because you have to see your Creator, be Jesus, Muhammad, whatever, in the image of you. Because there's a God in you. That God in you is what you have to aspire to in the God that you profess to believe in. I don't think that, however, brought about a fear of us doing for self and being race first. I think it impacted on our mindset first, but not fear. Because, see, if you say do for self and then the God you pray to don't look like you, then you will look to what represents that here, and then you aspire to be that. And so I think what you're in seeing God in your own eyes, then you can aspire to that. So doing for self is not necessarily hampered. But what you do is you look at God different than you, and you aspire to be that, and what you see that's closest to that is the other people. So you aspire to them, and therefore you think you're doing for self or doing better as a person because you aspire to that God, and that God resembles the God that you pray to. So when you change the God that you pray to, then your aspiration becomes to be that. And then for their doing for self is more prominent. But I don't think religion was the dominant factor, but I will say, because people have a tendency to forget this, that when the Portuguese went into Africa, the Portuguese king directed his people first destroy their belief in their own religion, in their own faith. Teach them to believe in our God. Teach them to revere our view. And therefore, it'll be easier for you to direct them because they will be believing that you are the representative of the God that you have taught them to believe in. That's you.
So in other words, the baseline, the God concept, I don't use the word total control. You can change it any way you want because it has to. In my mind view, when you control one's God instead of you being God yourself, sort of minimizes your thrust as a human to do those things that are possible or probable. An outside question, seemingly to not even be connected to what we're talking about. Why is it that white and white police can shoot us seemingly with no consequence, yet some of the people who claim to be conscious will talk about black on black crime while not talking about white on white crime?
I don't think you mean white on white crime. think you mean white on black crime.
No, I mean exactly what I said.
Well, because, see, they don't really talk about white on white crime.
Exactly, that's the point.
And the reason they don't talk about white on white crime is you don't necessarily see it. It happens. White people do the damnedest thing to white people, too. Am I really concerned about that? Really? They throw a white man in jail for 100 years. Am I concerned about that? They put Mumia in prison. I'm concerned about that. What we have to understand is that, yeah, you need to talk about black-on-black crime because that's the only way to begin to elevate us to a different level of action because we don't have to commit crimes against ourselves. So connecting that back to faith, for me, is also connecting it back to raising the moral character of our people so that we don't have to fall victim to the way white people define us. They define us as criminals. We've accepted that definition. Then they change your view of God, and then you accept that definition. So since I'm going to give myself the definitions of me and of my God, I can absolutely talk about black-on-black crime. But, yes, I'm going to talk about white-on-black crime because we have to understand your question related to a police officer shooting us with little to no response from the quote-unquote government, almost like a rubber stamp. There's a fear factor here. Police officers come to the table with a certain level of fear. I mean, because everybody wants to make sure that they go home at the end of their shift. See, so then there's a certain level of fear that exists between you and me, and maybe not you and me, between you and them. You have to also realize they bring their own baggage with them when they go to work. And since the police culture, and it is a subculture of a culture, and most of the times we don't understand that. It has its own set of rules internally. As a subculture, since they aren't the law, they are to enforce the law, and therefore they're not there to protect you. And we seem to think that they're supposed to protect us. They're there to provide a service. That's what they do. Service.
I got a question.
Protectors. Go.
I got a question. If I'm not mistaken, police officers are your employees. So if your employees are not doing as spelled out in their employee manual, and so on, so on, so on, why don't you just fire them? See, we make these things look as if they're big mountains. Around here in the Ferguson area, you have municipalities that have dissolved its police department, and rightfully so. So the rhetoric that I hear oftentimes makes it seem like you are not the boss, the payers of police officers. If you let your employees run amok in your community, well, you deserve what you get.
Well, you made a statement and a question, so I can respond if necessary. Because what I think, if you hear me, what I'm speaking to is the impact that happens because of the relationship that exists in that particular subculture. Now, if you say, hey, well, you pay the boss, well, actually, we don't. And that's where controlling the politics in your community controls the politicians in your community, and then you can make those politicians do exactly what you say. See, it's a stair step there. It's not a mountain, and it's not impossible. It's absolutely doable. It's doable because we have the ability to control the politics in our community and therefore control the politicians in our community. It's absolutely doable.
Well, yeah. We got 40 minutes. I'll put a recording on and
okay.
take the program out. But again, we state something that isn't for all of us. We state something that becomes an isolated incident. All right, I can state to you categorically that police officers are friends. I walk up, police officers are friendly. I can make that statement.
Okay.
Under an isolated situation, institutionalized training, I can say police officers are friendly, both white and black. You know, I can say that, right? But that's not the total experience.
But that's why Bianca's point was, you basically are the employers. And that part is true in one sense, that if we understand that in order to do away or change their mode of operation, you have to first understand the politics that created it and therefore your role in it and how you can exert a certain amount of power in order to change it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to understand that. So from the basis of not understanding it, the question was, why does the shootings happen? Not how do you control or stop it? See, yes, we can meet that challenge if we step up and actually begin to control the political situation that we're in and therefore direct how that is done. See, here, and I'm as most places, you have pieces or systems that overlay each other and interact with each other. So even if you met a nice police officer, it has nothing to do with how a police department is run or how other police officers react. It doesn't. So we can redirect this, but we have to have that mindset of controlling the things that take place in our community and not be dependent on someone else outside of our community to control it and then think they're going to control it in the way that we want it controlled.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to close out with political education. Are you ready for the doors of Division 121 to be open to the applicants in the community to come in for local political education and national UNIA government education?
As long as the conversation are respectful, regardless of whether we agree or disagree, we can all learn from each other. So opening the doors means opening the mind. And when you do that, the exchange of ideas, it's like there's really no argument here because in conversations that we have a different view, and that's fine because different views allow us to exchange those ideas and move forward, and that's what we have to do. So, yes, we can open the door, and when you talk about political education, you're talking about political conversation, and then we have to recognize on which foundation that's going to be. We actually do that here every other Tuesday with the group to come with Brother Samari, because
yes,
it's redefining community and redefining values and trying to do it collectively, so that we can therefore espouse those values out into our community and hope that that becomes collective. See, so political education, people have to understand. Well, I would like them to understand. They don't have to do shit. I like them to understand that everything in this world that we deal with right now is political. And if you don't understand and you don't interface or interact with the politicians in your community and then create the power base to impact on that particular situation, all of the rambling off we do is not going to get us a nation. Because we can keep talking. But it isn't about the talking. It's about the doing. And we got to get busy.
Absolutely. Well, we're getting ready to get busy. And Sunday, don't forget to come out to the mass meetings. The mass meetings are very important. They're not just about talk.
Mm-hmm.
We have to inform ourselves. We have to inform the citizens. And then we must roll up our sleeves and go to work. Every now and then, you need to come to a meeting. So when the meetings are held and the business meetings are held, you won't be coming off half-cocked. It's simple as that. You have to be around in order to know what's going around. That's what's going on. My good friend from Liberia, you chimed in late. I'm going to take a couple of minutes to listen to you.
I'm coming down.
Brother Wesley from Liberia. You're on.
I didn't mind.
Okay. You may be having a little bit of difficulty. You may have only been listening. So we're going to close out the program. We're going to go back to Dr. Ed Robinson and the Black History. No. I'm going to take you to the African Genesis Theory. All right? Wow. Look at the board.
Hey, we had so much technical difficulty today. I'm glad to see all of you chimed in. You really worked with it. And you missed a lot. Even Ohio was on the line. So, you know, I appreciate all of you being here. Tune in next Saturday at 9 a.m. And I hope to have another historical moment like this one. I'm getting a big head shake. No, it's a damn shame. I ain't doing my work today and forced his hand to be here next week. This was way too much. I really thoroughly enjoyed having you in the studio today. Yes, I did. All right. Dr. Ed Robinson, African Genesis Theory.
There's a racial animosity in America that's like a plague of sores festering on the skin of America. Sores that will not be healed by ointment or tincture or even a balm of sweet sage. It is a plague that will not go away and causes eyes in boardrooms of corporate America to lower when it's merely alluded to, causes eyes to lower in the halls of Congress. This hostility is directed at the African American by everybody, including the African American himself.
Fact, 11 teens per day are killed by violence.
Children killing children.
Nationwide, one out of four teens killed are killed by guns.
Five by shooting, where innocent bystanders died just as easily as the target.
Last year, in Philadelphia, 81% of the children killed that were 16 years of age and under were African American.
They say you're not allowed to bring no weapons and stuff, but you know, what about our protection? What's going to happen to us? What we going to do? If somebody try to come to us and do something else, what we going to do?
Across the country, 91% of all blacks murdered are murdered by blacks. There is no end in sight.
Many people have tried to figure out why this vastly disproportionate ills that black people suffer. Why? Some say, oh, it's lack of money. It's a disproportionate poverty. It's disproportionate joblessness. It's disproportionate dysfunctional families. We say it's none of these things. It's not lack of economic base, it's not lack of money, it's not lack of any of these things. We say that these things are the mere advents, are the mere manifestations, are the mere symptoms of a deeper single problem, one problem. And that problem, we give it the name of the problem. The problem. Now, the problem is that the entire society, inclusive of African Americans, had been programmed by the media to believe that African Americans' ancestors came from and evolved in an area in West Africa of abysmal ignorance, of subhumanness, of bestiality, of lack of any light of culture or education. Now, this problem divides itself into two impact areas. The first impact area we call psychic trauma. The second impact area we call absence of the territorial imperative. Now, psychic trauma comes from without, comes from the dominant group. Psychic trauma manifests itself in attacks of aggression, attacks on our genetic worth. Books are written. Humiliation abounds. Low teacher expectancy in the school so that 90% of our children can't learn. This manifests itself in what we call psychic trauma, coming from without. the stripping of the territorial imperative from us is that second impact stream. What did this do? It gives the feeling that we came from nothing, that we came from jungle. You see, the poison that comes out of the television and the motion pictures, degrading us, degrading our foreparents, the Tarzan movies, which degrade our African foreparents and our African brothers and sisters, is a poison that envelops you every day. You can't smell it, just like you can't smell carbon monoxide. And that poison that pours out of the television, out of the motion pictures, out of the non-minstrel shows which we look at every night, our children do, is like that poison which depresses our ability to do math, depresses our ability to achieve in business, depresses our ability to make the kind of marks that your intelligence would allow you to make. I'm going to apologize as a member of the older set. We're apologizing to you this morning for allowing the TV and the movies and the schools to continue to poison your mind. We kill each other because of that. Out of 10,600 deaths last year of blacks killing blacks, 6,000 of them were committed by young men between 15 and 24 for nothing, over nothing. He looked at me wrong. We hate each other because of the poison that's enveloped our minds from the motion pictures and from the TV and from the school textbooks. Now, the territorial imperative is an absolute. It's an absolute necessity for man to relate positively to the land of his ancestry. This will give him three things. Gives him stimulation, gives him security, and above all, gives him race esteem. Now, race esteem is the foundation for self-esteem. Without race esteem, you cannot have self-esteem. Race esteem is the flower, and self-esteem is the mere fragrance of that flower. Race esteem gives you the, and gives all African Americans, this pure foundation concerning our ancestry. It wipes away this lack of intrinsic value that white America has put on us. Let's make them believe that they're less than men, that they're really not human. They said, let's tell everybody that. Let's spread the word. We have control of the newspapers and the magazines. We have control of all of the media of communication. Let's make white people believe that. And then they won't establish abolitionist societies. They say, you know, that's a good idea. And in 1805, they began publishing in the newspapers and in the magazines this lie that our fathers and mothers came from a jungle. They did a good job. And they held on to that job until Tarzan came out in the movies in order to further reinforce that lie. And so our children grew up believing that lie. You are beautiful people. We have been programmed by the media, non-deliberately, in my opinion, non-deliberately lately, that is in the last 40, 50 years, to despise our looks through a psychological law called paired associate learning. By pairing our looks with degradation, with crime, lines of criminals, graffitied walls, torn down houses, other evidences of powerlessness and degradation. Nobody wants to be powerless. So everybody rejects those looks which are paired with that powerlessness. On the other hand, if a certain type of looks with poorly pigmented skin and unevolved hair and pinched features are always paired with beautiful surroundings, dressed in beautiful clothing, speaking beautiful language, solving great intellectual problems, doing great moral deeds, evidencing all of the facets of power, then everybody wants to identify with power and want to identify by association with those looks. This is why Napoleon, he didn't realize what he was doing, but when he saw my nose on the Sphinx, it tore him up to think that this great thing of power, this huge monument of power, that didn't look like him. So he ordered his soldiers to train their guns on the nose of the Sphinx to tear away the out-out cursed spot, as in Hamlet.
See, the old Europeans knew who we were. The Greeks knew who we were. That's why they had laws on the books of the United States forbidding us to learn to read and write, so we wouldn't find out who we are. No other race, no other group that people ever came to America's shores had laws on the books forbidding them to learn to read and write, forbidding them to know their language. They was beaten out of us with clubs. Not allowed to speak your own language. Not allowed to use your own name. We're the only race here that can't speak our own language, because it's beaten out of us on the plantations of the South. Make us feel that we're nothing, nobody. But you're in for something that's going to be beautiful. We're going to solve this problem. We're going to neutralize the poison that comes out of the television by having our own films showing the beauty and the grandeur and sophistication of the Songhai Empire.
The most powerful impact on the attitude is that which is the impact on your subconscious subliminally. You know, they outlawed subliminal advertising because it's so powerful. Subliminal means below the threshold of consciousness. You're not even conscious that this is happening to you. Take Color Purple. What big subliminal impact was in Color Purple? Well, because it's subliminal, out of a group of 500, nobody noticed it. What did Steven Spielberg do? And I don't think he did it, did it consciously. Look at the color of the men. Look at the color. Think about the color of the various men.
They had the darker men, the worst, the most bestial, the ones who raped their own daughters, who spoke bad language, spoke bad English, who were rough, uncultured, untutored. Now, the light-skinned man, who was Suge's boyfriend, he was light-skinned and he was very affable and very kind and very tutored. He was very nice and he greeted the ladies so wonderfully, and he was the epitome of a gentleman. Now, most people didn't notice the difference in color, but the subconscious did. Their subconscious noticed it and absorbed it, and not only absorbed it,
but reinforce the negativity of black and the positiveness of light skin.
Nobody alive today is responsible for that. So don't blame that on any white folks who are alive today. They're brainwashed too. White folks who are making the decisions in the school systems, who are making the decisions at television stations, are brainwashed. They really believe that we came from a jungle. So they're not doing it deliberately because they're brainwashed back between 1805 and 1850. So that one drop of that blood contaminates a white man. If those of you who saw Queen, remember what this girl looked like, a white girl, said to Queen. She said, one drop is too much. And that's because they made that blood contaminated in the school books, in the motion pictures, in television.
Since the problem is the programmed loathing and hatred of our African genesis, then the solution is the reprogramming of African genesis, the reprogramming of the beauty and grandeur and sophistication of African background, the reprogramming the great cities of the Western Sudan that led the world in science and humaneness, the reprogramming of our fathers and mothers who gave to the world the light humanity, the 14th, the 15th, the 16th, 17th centuries. And we can do that through and only through drama, because drama evokes the emotion that is necessary to penetrate as a sword the subconscious.
We'd just like you to control the impulse to fight one another. It was put in there on the plantation. That's how the man could control 500 brothers who could snap him across their knee, by putting them against each other. That's why we kill each other, because we still have that plantation hatred, saying that we're less than good. And we're saying to you, just a little while longer, we're going to clear the air and neutralize the poison that's coming out of television and radio and motion pictures and those sexually explicit songs you hear on Power 99 and those other stations. That's just to make you have children at any point and say, you see, they don't have any morals.
The Whispers of the Medallion, the motion picture, which is the culmination of years and years of testing as to what impact will the beauty of the ancestors of African Americans do. We started off with a book to see what impact it would have on thousands of people who would read the book. This book is called The Journey of the Songhai people. We are the Songhai people. That is, all the black people in South America, in the Caribbean, and in North America, and in West Africa, came from an empire, a 1,000-year-old empire in West Africa called the Songhai Empire. This was a conglomeration of 10 countries. Now, these countries are there. But at one time, we were together, united in an empire. It was made up of university cities and rolling farmlands, iron and steel factories, beautiful clothing stores, medical schools, law schools, to which universities Europeans came and studied at the feet of our fathers.
I'm not talking about thousands of years ago. I'm just talking a couple of hundred years ago. The CD of Black Rhapsody, considered the most outstanding historical CD in the country. It not only tells the history of the Songhai people, but it also gives the story of the songs that mothers and fathers gave to the world, over 6,000 songs, call them spirituals. Also, in this is the story of the eagle, who had been brainwashed that he was a chicken, and what became of that. It's a wonderful story. It's used by ministers all over the United States, and that's in this CD called Black Rhapsody. And finally, we have the Songhai, the Songhai Princess DVD. Now, this was a prelude for us to making sure that what they could see would change behavior. The whispers of the Medallion motion picture will expose millions to the wondrous beauty, grandeur, and sophistication of our ancestors, the love and honor of our Songhai ancient Egyptian ancestry will envelop them. Gone will be the present uncontrollable urge to kill and maim each other. Gone will be the uncontrollable urge to patronize others' business and none of our own. Race esteem will envelop us, creating the positive achievement of self-esteem. This is not just a pipe dream. For over half a century, we have tested this science of honoring the ancestors of our ancestral land. Thousands of our people have been exposed to the wondrous world-class literacy and science of our Songhai ancient Egyptian ancestors. The love and honor of our people enveloped them, and the self-hostility vanished. The thousands of school youths' marks miraculously rose, and their behavior became exemplary. This first picture, Whispers of the Medallion, is a fascinating love story, drenched in splendor and absolutely breathtaking, showing our homeland in deeply moving drama and excitement.